To most of us, the word home means more than just the place we sleep and keep our stuff. This hour, we'll talk about what home means and what it means to lose one and find one again. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Sally Ohms, author of Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. In her book, she profiles people who've been displaced by family pressures, economic pressures, and natural disasters. We'll talk about what she learned from them and what it means to lose a home and how their experiences changed their idea of what home is. We also want to hear from you. What does home mean to you? Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about what home means and how that meaning is often brought into sharp definition by the loss of a home. My guest today is Sally Ohms. She's a journalist who's worked all over the country and the author of Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. Hello, Sally.
Hi, Charity. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And we also this hour want to hear from you. We want to hear what home means to you. We want to hear if you've had an experience of losing your home. Many Iowans have lost their homes to floods, to tornadoes, to fires. We'd love to hear about your experience, whether you've lost your home literally or figuratively, and about your journey back home. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at IPR Talk. And Sally, you begin the book with this idea of losing a home, losing a house, which is something that you became fascinated with very early in your life.
I did, yes. So there's this image of me cowering in my basement, clutching my dachshund and my little flashlight, and I couldn't get my family. Mind you, I grew up in Missouri, and my parents became everyone became inured to the warnings. It seemed every day there was a tornado warning. Well, this happened to be a really very serious one. But they were a little bit cavalier, and they just wouldn't come down to the basement. The trees are bending. And so I went by myself. And just that those few moments, the lights went out, those few moments of thinking that I could lose everything.
Not just your house, but
not
your
just
family,
my house,
too.
My family. And yes, so all those things that mean home to you. Yeah. And it didn't come to pass. But I think that maybe that was a little bit of a seed.
Right. How old were you when that happened?
I was about 10. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was a very serious tornado. You write about watching the news coverage after,
yes.
And 46 people were killed in
yes,
that tornado?
Yes. It hit a suburb called, we were pretty much in the middle of the city. My father had this thought that tornadoes did not go through the middle of cities. He was disproved many times after that.
Yes.
But anyway, this was a suburb called Ruskin Heights. And if we'd had that designation EF5 tornado, which is the highest one I think now, like Greensburg, Kansas endured, I think it would have fallen into that category because it was a disaster. Yeah.
As you grew and you became a journalist, you also write that you found that a lot of the stories that you wrote seemed to revolve around people being displaced from their homes.
They did. I don't know. Displacement just became a big issue for me. And I don't know if because I kept writing about displaced people, then if my editor said, oh, okay, well, this is sort of her theme. But at one point, I went to Oklahoma and I interviewed Wilma Mankiller, who was the then chief of the Cherokee Nation. And that sort of set me on writing more about the Trail of Tears and Native American other forced moves on their part. And I've written about farmers who've been removed from their land and domain type situations. I've written about, I lived in a town in New Mexico where the mental hospital was, and so I wrote about the outpatients who would then find boarding homes and landlords would take advantage of them by taking their Social Security and so forth. So some examples.
Do you remember at what point you realized that this thread seemed to run through your work and your life?
Well, I think I started it on this book journey when I saw a lot of natural disasters happening. Katrina and then Greensburg, Kansas, and things, they seem to be becoming more prevalent and really sort of vicious. And so I decided that I wanted to talk to people who had been displaced or who were alienated or isolated from society. And I dragged this huge list around that I had created. Then people would grab it from me and say, oh, well, you've got to interview this person or this type of person. And so it grew and it grew. And, you know, I'd really be dead in my grave before I was able to complete this project. So I narrowed it down. So I have groupings of people who have similar types of displacement. And then the theme of home arose as our ubiquitous need for feeling at home, whatever that means to us. And so I start out with former foster kids.
And let's talk a little bit about the former foster kids that you talked to.
Yeah, sure.
And it was interesting in starting with this idea, you know, you're going to write about displacement, but many of the people that you wrote about not only were displaced from a home, but never really felt like they had a home.
Never had, yeah. That's really common with former foster kids who lots of times I think we know get tossed around from place to place and separated from their siblings. And they're a pretty determined group. These people I interviewed determined to create that functioning family that they never had.
Right. And a number of the young people that you talked to, most of the people that you talked to who were former foster children were in their 20s.
Yes.
So fairly
yes.
young.
Yeah.
But a couple of them were also parents. And there seemed to
yes.
be, particularly for those people, this very strong desire to create some sort of stable home. But again, it didn't seem to necessarily rely on the place.
No. And that's... Now, the home is just rarely just the structure, is it? That, of course, figures in largely. And you don't go telling people in Moore, Oklahoma or Colorado Springs who've lost their homes to fire lately that that isn't the strict definition of home. They've lost their home. They've lost everything. But they then I found since the people I interviewed were pretty much on the upswing, they had – so they're telling you – by the way, these are in first person, so they're people's accounts in their own words. And there's a sort of mourning period that people go through, and then they realize that home means a lot more to them than that.
When you approached people for these interviews, how did you lay out what you wanted to talk about?
Well, I told them this concept of I asked them to define what home had meant to them, and lots of times, I feel the same way. It changes, it evolves, and it means different things to you in different points of your life. So I asked them pretty much to tell me what had happened. Sometimes they would start at the beginning with their childhoods, and sometimes they would go right into the actual time when some disaster happened to them or something. And then pretty much, I mean, people say, what questions did you ask them? And people just started talking, and it was marvelous. I hardly ever had to interrupt except for clarification of certain things. And they just told it. And it was a wonderful kind of process. I felt bad at first because I thought, oh, I'm going to drag these people back through these horrible times. But they would start with that, and then they would say with a sort of sense of pride. I mean, they'd get to a sort of sense of pride, and their actual body language would change. At first, they were kind of hunched over lots of times, and then they'd see, look what I did. And of course, with the help of other people, I have helping people in here too. I have,
right?
Yeah.
people, and particularly in that chapter, when you're writing about former foster children, you also write about the people who have created scholarship programs and understand
wonderful
that,
people in San Diego County.
Aging out of the foster care system can be a brutal and difficult time for young people. You write about the fact that most of these people, or you just mentioned most of these people, are on the upswing. Was that a goal to collect stories that were empowering?
Yes. I really didn't want to create a book, woe is me, I lost my home, what am I ever going to do?
Because there are some heartbreaking
stories. Well, there are heartbreaking stories, but I thought that it served everyone, the readers, much better to hear encouraging stories and maybe get some ideas if they're in the same situation, or figure out a way maybe they could help in this same way. They could help people with a hand up. And I had a man come up to me and say, well, I don't need to read one more book about a bunch of depressing stories. And I thought, oh, horrors. No, that isn't what this is about at all.
Well, it's interesting because you write that sort of the germ of this idea came to you when you were watching all of the news coverage of Hurricane Katrina. You also at that time were a limousine driver.
I was.
You had fantasies of
like
taking
every
your limousine.
Writer, we've had lots of jobs.
Right.
Yes.
So you had fantasies of going and just picking people up and taking them somewhere safe.
Well, you know that helpless feeling that you have. What can I do? Obviously, I mean, people are counting on the government and on FEMA and everybody to come in, and it wasn't happening. And so anyway, yes.
Well, I wonder when did you move from thinking about that physical displacement that you saw during Hurricane Katrina to the more figurative displacement, the family pressures and that kind of thing that can then rob us of that feeling of home?
Yeah, well, and I mean, I think here maybe it's a time to kind of define or tell the definitions that I discovered of home means.
Well,
I mean,
we're actually going to take a short break.
Okay.
And then we will talk more about
the
definitions of different people's definitions of home and also get into more of those individual stories that you collected when you were talking to individuals about their experiences and what home means. We are going to take a short break. I'm talking with Sally Ohms. She is a journalist and also the author of Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. And we have this comment from Sarah on Twitter. I didn't understand what home meant until I studied abroad. I noticed all the things I loved and missed about Iowa, my adopted home. We also heard from Deb on Facebook. Home is where my dogs are, a house, an apartment, or a tent. And you're welcome to join our conversation with your definition of home at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the meaning of homes, of home, and what it means to lose a home, to find a home again. My guest today is Sally Ohms. She is a journalist, and she is the author of Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. In the book, she profiles individuals from all different backgrounds and walks of life who have had an experience of being displaced from their home for some reason, whether it's a disaster or family pressure, economic pressure, and tells of their journey back to a home, what home means to them. We want to hear from you as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. What does home mean to you? And what kind of journey have you taken? Again, 866-780-9100. And Sally Ohms will be reading this evening at 7 o'clock at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. Sally, I interrupted you earlier as we were starting to go over the list of the kinds of individuals that you talked to book. We've mentioned the foster kids, but can you give me a general idea of what some of the other groups that you profile are?
Yeah. So next I went on to interviewing combat veterans. Very often they come back from war with feeling ill at ease with the environment that they used to call home. And I talked to a lot of people here in Iowa about going to retirement homes. It's a big decision what you're going to do when you no longer, and anybody who's had parents who have been failing know what that decision entails. It's not easily made. And so I talked to some people in retirement homes and then some people who are really resisting going to retirement homes and what they were determined to do in big old houses where they lived all their lives and maybe even were born and raised their children. And then I spoke with immigrants and refugees who are now U.S. citizens. And I talked to homeless people, men, women, and children. I talked to, for example, formerly battered women. I talk with Native Americans, specifically Navajos, who are working to improve the quality of their land, or their homeland, I should say, and foreclosed on person, a man in Santa Fe who says if you follow his program, you don't have to be foreclosed on again. Very optimistic, great program. And victims of natural disasters, as I said, I started out with them. And then I've also included people who have been helping these other people. Very often, the people who've walked the walk are the ones who are just really able, for example, to give other people a hand up, they understand their situations and predicaments. Like the man who's the head of the Taos, New Mexico homeless shelter was once homeless himself. So, yeah, and in doing that, then I did come across a plethora of definitions about what home means to people.
Well, okay, let's explore some of those definitions. Yeah. And actually, you write that your mother had one that you learned very early on.
She really hated it when realtors would say home for sale. And she said, it's not a home. It's a house until the family moves in and makes it a home. Well, and of course, family is a very obvious big definition of home, your loved ones, your spouses. But I found community. It can be a community. It can be a region, religion, a spiritual practice, as in the case of the Tibetan American woman I interviewed in San Francisco. It can be just a place in your head or your heart. But no matter how it gets defined, it's bound up with our identity. And it's really the place, if you will, where we can feel we are our authentic selves.
Is safety a very important part of that definition for a lot of people?
Oh, sure, of course, yeah. I mean, the homeless people definitely have the hugest safety issues. Yeah, well, and people who have – in East Biloxi, the woman I talked to there, it was just days and days and days before there was any kind of a relief. They didn't even drop water, so – that they were in bad straits. Yeah.
You write about combat veterans, and that chapter I thought was really fascinating, not just because of the experiences that these people had gone through, but how going through an experience like that seems to change how they think about the home that they have known. Mm-hmm. What did you find from
it's
people?
It's really more how they feel about the home they've known. It's PTSD and traumatic brain injury are really big issues now. There are a lot of people coming back. I have a couple of Vietnam veterans who address that. When they came back, there's something wrong with your head. Well, you were kind of a wuss or you were discounted. And certainly the VA didn't want to admit that this was a situation that was going on for a long time. Now the VA, I think, is trying its best to address people with PTSD. It's just that they're so overworked and they so underfunded now. But we have waves and waves of men and women who are coming back with both of those conditions. And we're going to have to need to look to that. So anyway, I thought that the two Vietnam veterans I interviewed were really interesting in that they have come out. I mean, the inclination is sort of to go into your cave and stay there and not interact socially. I guess that's one of the symptoms. And there's a man who is in Colorado Springs who has started a group called Veterans Remember. And he brings together veterans and he puts them in the middle of a circle. And then around them are a circle of family. And then members of the public are allowed to come in this outer circle. And the veterans speak and he really believes in the power, the healing power of telling your story. And they've just had some wonderful and amazing sessions. They do it about four times a year. And then the family begins to realize more. Sometimes he said they say things that they've never said in front of their families. So they feel comfortable speaking to one another about these things. And then the families begin to feel comfortable bringing up these things. And then the public gets an education about what's going on for these people.
Yeah. And that strikes me that in this case, home has changed, has altered for these people because they have altered.
That's
and,
right.
And I mean, really,
that's
they're
right.
in very literally yeah. their brain chemistry and
yeah.
and how they view the world has
yeah.
altered. But that changes dramatically home.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to just read
sure.
one little section here. This is from a woman in San Diego County who's taking advantage of this scholarship that is designed. It's a nonprofit design strictly for former foster kids to get their education. And she, when I went to see her, she lives in a tiny house in San Diego County, and she has one bedroom. She has adopted her teenage sister, and who's not an easy teenager. And anyway, they are living in the living room. I mean, they were sleeping in the living room because, or they were at the time because their 98-year-old grandfather was basically dying in the only bedroom. So they had that was the place where they had for him, and so they were caring for him. He was on hospice, and he did die within about a week after I came. And meanwhile, she's holding down jobs and she's going to school. But I thought it was really touching what she said. And I really, really agree with her. She says, I've been trying to find make a home lots of times, but I found it has to happen inside me. The only thing I can do is control me. I'm a spiritual person. I rely on a higher power. But I find that home is within myself. And that pretty much says it for me.
Although I think that that's something that we all have to journey to
yeah,
discover.
Absolutely.
And you write in the chapter about people who are struggling with foreclosure, mm-hmm. About a woman who was just so desperate to hold on to her home. Describe her story for me.
Well, yeah, she grew up in Illinois, met her husband there. They moved to be closer to his parents outside of Kansas City when they had children, and her parents were dead, so they wanted grandchildren around. They had three boys, he went to work and she went to work, and they came home and they had a boat and they took the kids out to fish, and it was just a completely wholesome kind of story. So she took the kids to ski in Colorado over a spring break, I believe it was. And she came home and the dining room set was gone. So she couldn't figure out what was up with that. Her husband said, well, he had sold it. And this was such peculiar behavior. And his behavior became more and more peculiar. And then he moved in with some other woman. And it became apparent that he was a methamphetamine. He'd gotten into that. And so he was an addict. And she just went, she had a house foreclosed on, and because they had kind of overextended to build this big, beautiful house. And, but this was in the days before foreclosure. And she then had a period where she had to really kind of hide her children from him because she didn't feel they were safe. So she rented this horrible house that had snakes in the walls. I mean, you know, it's just an awful tale. I mean, I don't laugh by myself because she laughed when she was telling me this. So often people, when they look back, they see a little bit of humor in this. And then she rented an apartment. It was just a tiny apartment for the three of them. She's raising three boys on a housekeeper's salary. And she still is. She has a house now, but she still just feels that she's completely living on the edge. I mean, and she's just done desperate things. For example, she gave her child one Christmas, one of the boys, he liked music, and so she gave him a coupon to take lessons. But the lessons weren't going to start until she really hadn't actually purchased it. And the lessons were going to start until March because that's when she saw that she'd be able to afford them. I mean, everything. Other kids would come over to just hang out, and she couldn't afford pizza. So sometimes the friends would say, okay, well, let's have a pizza. And she'd say, okay, can you pay for it? I mean, really, really hard things for both herself and the boys, but she's just such a determined person.
Well, and that experience of having so much and then having so little, but
yes,
but clearly
it's a shock.
Not necessarily. I mean, obviously, she wanted it for herself as well, but mm-hmm. the pain that was caused because she couldn't give those things to
exactly.
her sons.
Can you imagine? Absolutely. Yeah.
So, what was her definition of home? What did she come to learn about home?
Well, I think that she, the most important thing was providing stability for her children. So however she was going to do that, or even if she had to just fake it, that was it. So family is most important. Now that one of them has grown and out of the house, and so the other two are coming along, she said to me she fought so long and hard for this little house in suburbia, and there are definite problems with it, but she just keeps putting in that new window and, you know, finding something for the roof. And so it for her really is, she said, I'm not leaving this place. This is home. So and of course, all the associations of having raised her boys there then contribute to that.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I'm talking with Sally Ohms. She is the author of Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. And we want to hear your story this hour as well. Let us know what home means to you. And if you've taken an interesting journey to find your home, or if you had an experience that revealed to you what home is for you in a surprising way, we want to hear your story. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have this from Linda on Facebook. She says, my home is like a third skin. I keep it healthy and organic, so it nourishes me and my family. I live in an old farmhouse built in 1910, cited for prevailing breezes and heated with hot water radiator heat, so it doesn't have air ducts snaking through the house. I've lived here for 36 years, have reared four children here, have organic gardens and a kitchen fitted out for canning and cooking from scratch. I love my house. It's like one of my kids. And did you talk to people who felt that way about the physical presence of their houses, of their homes?
Absolutely, yes. I just went yesterday and visited the sister of an interviewee who passed away recently. And it was in Fort Madison. And her father had built this house. She had been raised in the house. She and her husband spent a short time away. and when he was in the service. But they'd come back and they'd raise their children in the house. So this house really meant so much to her. And she said, the grandchildren come now and they say, oh, Grandma, we just love this house. And she says, oh, I don't know. Sometimes I wonder. It's old. She got to the point where she was falling down and she had to go down to the basement to take her laundry. So she had to be really careful. And she just said, she said to her doctor, okay, I don't know why I'm still alive, but here I am. And the worst thing for me would be to go to a nursing home. And so he kind of investigated a little further what her situation was, why she was falling down. And turns out she needed a pacemaker. So she had a pacemaker put in. And I mean, people do lots of things to say, oh, no. And I think farming people particularly have roots to the land. I did a story one time in California about a Delta area where they were going to have something called a peripheral canal. And essentially, there was going to be saltwater intrusion into the land where they were farming. And they said to these people, oh, but that's okay. We're going to give you another farm. Well, no.
It's not the same.
It just doesn't work like that.
We have to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. I'm talking with Sally Ohms, author of Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. She'll be reading this evening at 7 o'clock at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa.
My stubborn ways are behind me now. They're behind me now, and there's nothing here that will not break down like you never did. The kids say,
it's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the definition of home, and we would love for you to join our conversation as well. What does home mean to you? What kind of journey did you have to go on to find your home? Give us a call at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm talking with Sally Ohms. She is the author of Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. And you did spend quite a bit of time in Iowa talking with people who were at that point in their lives where they had to decide whether or not to leave their homes. And that's a very difficult decision for a lot of people. I think it's something a lot of people in Iowa, particularly right now with our aging population, really struggle with. Did you find a lot of investment in that physical place?
Well, when I talk to a man who owns or co-owns six different retirement homes, he pointed out that lots of times the physical challenges are what determine that decision. And he said that sometimes children, meaning the younger generation, will try and take people into their – will try and take their elders into their own home. And it doesn't work out. I mean, lots of times they're lonely because everybody goes off to work and they are not prepared to take care of the physical things that are going wrong. It's really hard, and it kind of erodes the relationship. So he said that lots of times people were really resistant until they had – they just really couldn't care for themselves very well anymore. And that can be anything from not being able to make a bed to cooking and needing social interaction. And then when people would move, he said 9 times out of 10, they'd say, oh, why didn't I do this before?
Right.
Which is kind of damning for the children when they hear that. It's like, right. Oh, we're trying to tell you.
But I think there is that fear of losing so much. I have a very good friend who has passed away, and she stayed on her farm probably far longer than she would. But it was a Century Farm. It had been in her husband's family for over 100 years, sure. And no one in the family wanted it.
Yeah, that's...
So she knew that when she moved, that farm would be sold.
Yeah.
And, you know, she had lived there for many years. Her husband had passed away years before. But, you know, it was the end not just of her independence,
yes,
but of so much more.
Sure, sure. And not being able to drive lots of times enters into that. I mean, we're such drivers, aren't we?
Yes.
We don't realize it until we can't.
Well,
or,
and in a rural state like Iowa, it's an even more difficult situation for people when they lose the ability to drive. We have a number of callers on the line who want to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. Mary is on the line in Altoona. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I'm married to a farmer who owns a Century Farm. You know, the family's been on this land since the 1860s. But I did not grow up that way. I was a city kid and was a preacher's kid. And we lived in many different houses in many different states. But my mom had the gift of that art of being just a fabulous homemaker. And she had it down to a T. And she would transform whatever rectory we were in into, as best she could, with six kids on a preacher's salary, you know, into just a lovely home. And even today, even though I'm in my 60s and my mom is 95, kind of now wherever mom is still kind of just considered home.
That's so interesting. And you must have a different idea of home than your husband, considering the deep roots and the background that he has on the land.
Exactly. It is different. And I appreciate it. You know, I mean, I really appreciate, you know, his connection to the land and what it is, and that he goes to the cemetery and, you know, all his relatives are right there nearby in the cemetery. And I don't have that. You know, mine are all spread out. So mine's kind of just more connected with where my mom is. And, of course, now I'm a grown-up. I've created my own home and my own family and hopefully use some of her skills to do that for them.
That's wonderful, Sally.
But did you use your mother as a model and have some sort of confidence then when you were in this situation where you hadn't been in this kind of environment?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, as far as sitting at my home, and it's very important to me, you know, that it's welcoming and there's food there and that it's clean and warm and taken care of. And my husband's a man of great faith, too, so we kind of link together on that issue. But so, yeah, it's just... Yeah, it worked really. It helped me a lot of my adult life, the family.
Mary, thank you so much for calling and sharing.
You bet. Mm-hmm.
And we've been talking so much about the word home, but when she uses the word homemaker, that carries with it so much meaning as well, and what one person in your life has the ability to do.
Yes. Yeah. I think that. Also, if the most important thing really is being with that person, then you find a way to create what maybe a new definition of home again. But yeah,
Janet is on the line in Kelowna. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I just want to make this brief. I always had the idea that a house is just a structure. It's a house, but a home is. Well, like the proverbial saying, a home is where the heart is, where you have family. And I'm 68. I've traveled a lot. I've had a lot of different houses. And I can't say that I have really felt like a house is a home, I guess, because for the past, oh, I'd say 30 years or so, I've been by myself. And... I haven't had that feeling exactly of home, but then it dawned on me, I visited my son for a few days, and I said, I can't wait till I go home. So I thought, well, you know what, what is home? I didn't really consider it home, but I was glad to go back home.
So, Janet, do you feel like a lot of us put too much emphasis on that physical place?
More so on the physical place than on the people that are in it. I think that's what makes a home a home, is the people that are in it. Otherwise, it's just a house.
Janet, thank you so much for calling.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
by. And that lesson that Janet is sharing is one that a lot of people have to learn the hard way. And you wrote about a lot of people who were physically displaced by Hurricane Katrina, by the tornado in Greensburg, Kansas. Was that something that an epiphany that you found a lot of people having?
Well, yes. Yes, because after there's that mourning period, I've lost my beautiful home, they say. They don't usually say house. Then they sent for Greensburg, for example, was interesting because people, the town of, I think, 2,400 people, only 8 people died, luckily. And they got together and said, okay, a lot of people said, well, there goes Greensburg.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, yes, that's the end. I remember that's the end of that town. It was a small town. It was completely flattened.
Yes. Yeah. And so then they're built of better stuff than that, I guess. They're pretty determined. And they started, first of all, some University of Kansas architecture students came and they built a prototype LEED Platinum building, which is this high designation of green sustainable building in the town. And that served as a little bit of an inspiration. They started thinking, well, we could be a model town. And they decided they would build their civic buildings in a green manner. LEED Platinum, they all are, which is kind of expensive, although you get great returns immediately. Their hospital, their school. And now you go to the town and it's really it's a tourist destination. But the whole idea is that home for them was this community, and they were going to rebuild their community, and they were going to do it with the kind of spirit that said, let's improve this while we're at it. Let's make this – of course, it was special to them before, but let's make it more special.
Well, and it's interesting to draw a comparison between New Orleans, mm-hmm. which, of course, mm-hmm. has such a storied history and mm-hmm. is so mm-hmm. famous, and tourists flock there,
yeah.
and Greensburg, Kansas, where tourists never went.
That's right.
But still, there was that really strong attachment to place, regardless of house, in both of those places.
To the region, New Orleanians are a different kind of breed. I mean, they have a strong Catholic roots, big families. They have, obviously, we all know they have great ties to food that's produced in that region. And they're just a whole culture.
Right. Music and language, everything.
I guess we also could throw culture into the mix of being making you feel at home. Yeah,
definitely. Rachel's on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Rachel.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to share?
So I just think this is very serendipitous that you're talking about this today, because I just spent the summer organizing an art show called Why Houses Matter. Mm. It opened last Friday. And so I've spent the summer talking with 5 Iowa artists about why houses matter to them. They made paintings, sculptures, installations about the house, about that idea of home. And it's just been this very big discussion about what makes a house a home. And I don't know. It's just so kind of freaky that you are here asking this question.
So,
you know,
Rachel, I'm curious, since obviously it has been your job to help other people explore this issue, but what have you learned throughout this process about what home means to you?
Well, it started from being obsessed with the actual house. I'm a renter. I don't own a home. But for probably 2 years, I've been obsessively looking at photos of pictures over the real estate listings, because it's very accessible now. And I've fallen in love with many houses, probably 5 dream houses, like stopped in my tracks, forgot everything that I was doing. And for the next couple hours, tried to figure out, can I do this? I'm not in a position to do that. It's just this whole mental fantasy for me. And what's kind of become obvious is my identity of who I think I can be in these houses. And it's been kind of a harsh reality to realize, you know, when I can't possess them, you know, why did, so So why does that matter, or why does that obsession persist? So that's why I wanted to engage in a larger scale and invite other people to kind of tell me why houses matter to them. It was a really great experience.
Sally? Yeah, well, there's a guy in my book who talks about your house, your owning a home ownership as being the great American dream, of course. And so he really feels very bad that a lot of people were hoodwinked into buying houses that were not within their reach. And he has a program to educate people. But that's really interesting because we do. I do that all the time. I was a renter until I was 54 and then finally was able to buy a house. But, the dream, just the dream, it's one of our big things in the United States, I think.
And Rachel, you mentioned that this opened last Friday. How long will it be on display?
It's on display until October 4th. The show is at a cleaning supply warehouse in Urbandale called Hilliard. It's on 109th, but the street is also 112th. So it's kind of like going on a fantastic journey to try to find it. But they're open Monday through Friday, 8 to 4. So there's a lot of opportunity to see it, and I think the show is really strong. We have some really talented artists participating.
Okay,
so I would
great.
Encourage everyone to go.
And these are paintings?
Paintings, sculptures, installations. Everyone's from the Des Moines area except for one of the artists, Julia Franklin. She's a professor at Graceland in Lamoni, and she did a couple installations of actual house parts that she's collected over the summer from houses in Lamoni.
All right, Rachel, thank you so much for calling. And she was talking about Why Houses Matter, which is an art exhibit on display through October 4th in Urbandale. And we have just a couple of minutes left, Sally. And I wonder, through all of your conversations and your exploration, and you have lived over 20 different places in your life, so you're someone who hasn't spent too long in
yes.
one stationary place.
Yes.
So through all of this journey, your life journey and the journey of writing this book, what did you learn about home?
And actually, I have stayed some places a long time. So that shows even more how I did sort of flit around when I was younger. But I've found that I've moved for jobs, when I look back at it, to attend different schools, a spouse's job. I felt a bit of the wanderlust, but I've never experienced the type of displacement that my interviewees have. But to me, it has to do more with the person I'm with, as one of your callers mentioned. And also, she mentioned, if you're alone, then how comfortable you feel with your own life. That has a big – and then for me, a community of friends is just really important. I read a William Blake quote the other day. It said – how's it go? The spider a web, the bird a nest, man friends. And I'm sure he means men and women, of course. that to me is really, really important. And then I love natural beauty. So love to be in a home where there's, create a home where it's beautiful.
Sally, thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Sally Ohms is the author of Finding Home, How Americans Prevail, and she will be reading tonight at 7 o'clock at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. And with me now is Ben Kiefer, the host of River to River, today at noon. What's your plan for the show today, Ben?
Hi, Charity. Perhaps you and others heard the news that the last group of secret recordings that Richard Nixon made while he was president were released. This batch, over 300 hours of it, from 1973. In the midst of the Watergate scandal some 40 years ago. We'll have Dennis Goldford on the program to share his thoughts about these newly released recordings. Talk a little bit about the legacy of Watergate. Also, an update on the Farm Progress Show. That's in its last day over in Illinois. So we'll talk a little agriculture as well.
All right. And you've listened to all 300 hours of these recordings.
I'm getting down to the last few hours. By showtime, I'll fast forward through those. Yes, of course. Charity, thanks.
Ben Kiefer, host of River to River, coming up today at noon. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, it's Horticulture Day. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.
And although this wave is stringing us along, just know you're not alone, 'cause I'm gonna make this place your home.